right. Thank you guys for sticking out to the very bitter end here. I appreciate it. And thank you again for inviting me to come and talk to you today. I am a soil microbiologist, and I look at the interaction of soil microbial communities with plants. And I'm going to talk today about sequencing tools that have been basically developed in the last 10 years, primarily coming from human studies, but are now starting to be applied to environmental studies and soil studies. And to be honest, I've mostly in the past worked more specifically with general bulk soil, but I'm now starting to apply these techniques to looking at the rhizosphere, and I think there's a lot of potential for that translation. So you're probably aware of this, but just to make sure we're on the same page, as far as what can sequencing data tell us about the rhizosphere? So in the last 30 years or so, we've realized that actually only 1% of all soil microbes can actually be cultured in the lab. And so if we really want to try and understand the interaction between soil microbes, rhizosphere, community, and plants, we need to use culture-independent techniques. And sequencing is a fantastic and powerful tool for trying to look at those interactions. And as you're probably aware, the rhizosphere community, those microbes can have a powerful impact on the plant itself. So I'm going to provide sort of a basic overview of how you might approach a sequencing project, some things that you need to consider, some of the limitations, some of the frustrations, and just give a rough overview. I'm not going to go into a lot of specific details on some of the nitty-gritty techniques, but again, just as an overview. And so you're probably aware Sanger sequencing has been around since the late 70s. I mean, sequencing in itself is not a new technique. But what is new in the general sense is this what we call next generation sequencing. And so this was the first commercially available method was called 454 pyrosequencing, developed by Roche. And this was called pyrosequencing basically because when the DNTPs are incorporated, they're detected by a release of pyrophosphate, so hence pyrosequencing. And this really became commercially available roughly 10 to 15 years ago. And so since that time, there's been basically an explosion in the technological capabilities of this type of sequencing. And so on this graph, we've got time and the number of sequences per lane on the y-axis. In addition, the size of the dot indicates the read length. And so you can see that over time, we can have many, many more sequences per basically lane in a sequence setup. And the length of the sequence that we can detect is increased in size greatly. So this is just a continual, new technologies are continuing to be developed for this too. What's more relevant possibly to those of us who don't work for the NIH is the fact that this has dramatically decreased in cost. And this is what's making this move from this technology being used in human systems, at least in my opinion, to environmental systems and plant systems much more possible. And so, in the early 2000s, it could cost, over $10 million to sequence one genome. Today, that cost is considerably less. This graph shows cost per genome, but for amplicon sequencing, which I'll talk about here in a second, this will depend on what sequencing center you use. But for an example, I'm working with a sequencing center right now where I can get bacterial sequences for a sample for about $40. So before I go further, I also want to clarify some terminology. So I've been talking about next generation sequencing. You'll hear it called NGS. This is also called targeted amplicon sequencing or massively parallel sequencing. And the most common uses are for looking at, say, the 16S rDNA, all of the bacteria in a sample or all the fungi in a sample. But you can also target any gene of interest for your study. I'm on a study right now that's looking at sequencing all of the NIFH gene, all the nitrogen fixation gene, in a series of samples. And so that can, you know, again, be very powerful when you're trying to identify all of the organisms in a community that might do that particular task. This is not to be confused with metagenomics. And so sometimes you'll hear these terms used interchangeably, and they're not the same thing. So metagenomics is basically the study of the entire genome or all the genomes of everything in your sample. One of the common ways for environmental samples is to do something called shotgun metagenomics, where you basically have the DNA broken into teeny tiny pieces. All of those pieces are sequenced, and then using software and algorithms and math and magic things, those are stitched back together to identify the organisms. This is sort of, at least in my mind as a microbiologist and microbial ecologist, sort of the holy grail, because by having the entire genome of everything, you can look at not just who these folks are, but what they might be doing. That said, this is still a really expensive process for environmental samples. I recently priced it out because I want to do this. It's like $500 a sample. And on top of that, what you really need to be able to do is have an estimate of the number of organisms that might be in your sample so that you can make sure you're getting the proper coverage. And in a soil sample or a rhizosphere sample, getting that estimate is not a trivial matter. And so that's why you'll see some papers using it, but it's still not as common as I think most of us would like. But I'm confident that, you know, with time, things will get better. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on sequencing platforms. There are a lot of them. I've listed some of the most common here. Within each of these companies, there are multiple models of these instruments. I did want to point out that the forefathers, Roche 454, is actually not really being supported anymore, which just illustrates how fast this technology is moving, because that was just 10 years ago. Illumina MiSeq is probably the most common, and all of these, again, have sort of their pros and cons, and it really depends on what your question is, what your project is, and unfortunately, what your budget is. The thing, though, that can make this slightly more palatable is this technique called barcoding or multiplexing, and this is basically where you can sample a sequence, all of your samples from an entire project at one time. Because through a step called library preparation, you can have a barcode attached to all the DNA in a sample from one site, and you'll have a different barcode on all the DNA in a different site. You pull those together, and after it's all sequenced, you can use software to identify which sample came from which treatment. And so that's time-saving, fantastic tool. So as I mentioned, that's done during something called library preparation. What library preparation involves is going to depend on your sequencing platform, but like DNA extraction, all of these platforms have commercial kits for you to do this. That said, there are pros and cons to doing it yourself. Obviously, a pro is that it can usually save you some money. The risk is that if you make a mistake during library preparation, you won't probably know that you made a mistake until after sequencing, which is a really expensive mistake to potentially make. And related to that, most sequencing centers, they do this all the time. And so they have all the tools, they have a lot of people that are familiar with those techniques. But again, that's something you have to judge. So in my lab, at the Southwest Florida Research Education Center, how do I do this? So first we'll collect a soil sample or a rhizosphere sample. And for sample collection, as Dr. Liso pointed out, more is better. Replication is critical. Most DNA extraction kits require less than a gram of soil. The common one, Mobot, now QIAGEN, is 0.25 grams. So if you're talking about a field study, that's not that much. There's no way you can possibly account for the heterogeneity, but you can at least make an attempt. So what I like to do is sort of a compromise, because DNA extraction is significantly cheaper than sequencing. And so I just threw up a little example here. Say you have six blocks. Each block has two treatments, a blue and a green treatment. And I will collect DNA from every single sample and extract DNA from every single sample, but then I'll pool it for each block. And so rather than sending 24 samples, I will send six blue samples and six green samples. And so that's it's a little bit of a compromise in the budget, but trying to account for heterogeneity. So you collect your samples, then you extract your DNA, and so, there's no standard method for rhizosphere extraction at this point. There are a bunch of papers out there, all of them do it slightly differently, but in general, the main distinction seems to be on whether you're trying to get rhizosphere or something deeper, like the rhizoplane. And so if you see a paper that's talking about sonication, that's usually going to get you more than just the rhizosphere. That'll likely get you the rhizoplane. And so I've found for rhizosphere, just gently washing the roots, either in water or I use a PBS, sterile PBS solution, works pretty well. That will also depend on your soil type. I work in Florida, it's beach sand, it comes off pretty easily. If you work in clay soils, you might have to do a little bit more optimization. And then basically you take that material, I spin it down, and I use that in a standard soil DNA extraction kit. So you've got your DNA, you send it to a sequencing lab, or you do it in-house if you're so lucky, and you get gigabytes worth of stuff that look like this. Up until now was the easy part. Figuring out what that means is, and I can't emphasize this enough, is no trivial task if you've tried. I think most of us that do these days are self-taught, unless you're fortunate enough to work with a bioinformaticist. It is possible. But it is a steep learning curve. And so luckily there are a huge number of tools and programs available for this. And most of them are free, which is also a benefit. There is actually one, there are a couple that you have to pay for, but to be honest, I've never used it. I've always used the free stuff. Some of the most common are Chime. Chime is actually now coming out with Chime 2 that is supposed to be even more user-friendly. Chime 1, the original Chime, and a lot of these are command line programs, and so that does also require some knowledge. But I think what's really exciting about this is, again, this field is changing dramatically, and basically it feels like new software programs are being written every week. And so if you have a question and you want to analyze it a certain way and the program doesn't exist, it'll probably be there in a couple days. And so I've just listed a couple that I found particularly useful. And so I just wanted to go through real quick a couple of examples of what sorts of data you can get from doing sequencing, and again, looking at how this might influence our understanding of the rhizosphere and rhizosphere interactions. So this is a fairly common, just looking at straight up bacterial abundance, different taxa. This is a trial that I'm doing right now in the greenhouse with different citrus rootstocks and applying different biostimulant products to them. And so each color represents a different bacterial taxa. The size of that bar indicates the abundance. So you can start to use that to tease apart what organisms are actually changing. And you can run standard statistics and ANOVAs and things like that to figure out which are statistically different. But what's really important, and Dr. Lysa talked about this as well, is the power of correlations and trying to figure out why these organisms might be present in one sample and not in another. And so correlating that with your horticultural data is, I think, what's ultimately going to at least give us a glimpse as to why these things might be going on. So I'm doing that right now, again, with that greenhouse project. It's a greenhouse and a field trial. We've got a whole bunch of different citrus rootstocks. We're applying either this seaweed product or this consortia of microbial or bacterial groups. And then I'm working with a plant physiologist, collecting a whole lot of different horticultural data. And so we can see just in the greenhouse some really dramatic changes between these different treatments. And so we can look at these and get these horticultural data. And then try and relate that, though I haven't made it to this step yet, unfortunately, with these changes that we're seeing in the bacterial community composition. So this is a PCOA plot. And so each dot represents the overall bacterial community composition of that sample, and so the closer together those dots are, the more similar they are. And so you can see in the middle we have this US 802 citrus rootstock, and there is a clear, distinct separation of the bacterial community composition between the control and the plants that had this microbial product added. to illustrate the importance of replication and what we all know, that what happens in the greenhouse doesn't happen in the field necessarily. These bottom graphs are some different rootstocks, though we have 802 was an overlap rootstock that were grown in the field, and the same microbial product was added. And you can see that we don't see that clear separation. Some of that could be, again, because of the sample number is different, so we're repeating this greenhouse trial right now to try and address that. Something else that's, again, I think a really powerful tool that I'm just now starting to play with is network analysis. This is, again, data from that greenhouse project, and so we can start to use that to try and, again, look at it in a different way what the interactions are between the microbial groups, who is only found in these certain treatments, who is not found in those treatments, and how those communities work together. And then what I think is another tool with a lot of potential is there's a program called PyCrust. And as I mentioned earlier, the metagenomics, by looking at the functional capabilities, what we're really going for. But again, it's expensive. And so PyCrust is trying to sort of bridge that gap by taking what is known about bacterial taxa and their genomes that have been sequenced and what functional capabilities those bacteria have, and trying to pair it with, say, your 16S bacteria data from sequencing, and say, well, because you had those bacteria in your sample, you might have these functions. And it's not perfect, and most of that database, again, is based on what we know about bacteria in humans or animals, but again, provides a hint at what might be going on. And so this is, again, that same trial. This is fatty acid metabolism, and doesn't look like they're actually statistically different, but it can see that there might be some trends in these in fatty acid metabolism going on in these samples. And so again, it's a tool to try and start to put together this puzzle of what is driving these communities. Just real quick, a few additional considerations. You probably realized I've pretty much just focused on bacteria. Unfortunately, there is a reason for that, and that is mainly because the fungal database is still not nearly as good as the bacterial database. I recently sent some samples off for ITS sequencing, got them back, and 50% were unknown. And so it's really hard to make comparisons with treatments if most of them don't come up as anything. That said, these things are being improved, you know, on a daily basis. So I don't think that it means you shouldn't try and do fungal sequencing, but just understand that it could be very frustrating. Again, I can't emphasize enough how the data analysis is a non-trivial task, and if you are able to work with someone who's actually trained in bioinformatics, that will really help. But I also want to emphasize how exciting and potentially important this tool is for understanding these interactions. And I think this is a really exciting time, certainly for as a microbiologist, but I think also just as scientists trying to figure out how the rhizosphere interacts with plants. I think these are the tools that we really want to look at. And so thank you very much. The question was about super high density barcoding. I haven't personally yet, but that is something that's becoming available, and it also depends on the sample number. And so there is a limit to the number of samples you can sequence at one time. I've gotten close to that number, but I haven't broken it yet, and that also depends on your platform. So. That's a good question. The question is about the study that I'm doing with these microbial products on these citrus seedlings. This is an ongoing project. So that was just our first pass in a greenhouse study. And so So within the greenhouse, it looks really nice, but that's also on, you know, potting mix and in a very controlled condition, and we're not seeing those same trends in the field, but that's something that we're poking at in much greater detail. So. No, those plants were, they were standard treatment for citrus seedlings in a greenhouse. So.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.